The dawn of a decade. 1970 marked the start of a new chronological unit, but it was really a continuation. A continuation of the fight to make planet Earth a better place to live, and a struggle to hold on to established traditions and procedures in the face of often violent opposition. Dawn of a Decade, produced by WBBM News Radio 78, written by Don Perlman. I'm Tom Clark. Most of the major events of the year seemed interrelated. In retrospect, these were not so much single occurrences, but rather parts of a huge puzzle that historians will someday look at and understand. Understand how the events of the year laid the groundwork for the events and occurrences of the decade to come. This, then, is 1970, dawn of a decade. The United States was undergoing its worst inflation in 20 years. The United Auto Workers strike against General Motors, idling 400,000 workers for 2 months, was no help to the economy. There were strikes by postal workers, a walkout by truck drivers, which was especially costly to the Chicago area, and a one-day shutdown of the nation's railroads. Some Chicagoans went without milk while drivers hammered out a contract with the dairies. Twice, President Nixon called for voluntary wage and price controls, in June and again at the end of the year. But the president always maintained an optimistic outlook.
The American economy is the strongest in the world. This year, the number of Americans who have jobs is the highest in our history. Even allowing for taxes and inflation, the average real income of Americans is higher this year than ever before, in part because of the increase in Social Security benefits and the reduction of the tax surcharge, which will end entirely this month. Now, because of that basic economic strength, we can honestly and confidently face up to our current problems. Unemployment has increased. The price index continues to rise. Profits have gone down. The stock market has declined. Interest rates are too high.
But the cost of living continued to rise during 1970. Unemployment was at its highest peak in 7.5 years, with almost 6% of the nation's workforce out of work. One good sign, the stock market rallied in the closing weeks of the year. The economic situation was exemplified at home with the Chicago Transit Authority. CTA Board Chairman George Dement begged the Illinois legislature for $50 million to subsidize financially burdened public transportation. There followed a long, fruitless struggle in the state capitol, with Republicans unable to agree to a plan by the Democrats, and the Democrats not agreeing to the GOP plan. In early August, the CTA raised its fares to 45 cents, 55 if you wanted a transfer. During the next few days, the state's top two politicos, Governor Richard Ogilvie and Chicago Mayor Richard Daley, blamed each other for the legislative deadlock that killed any aid for transportation.
The failure to provide money for the CTA has forced a fare increase. The responsibility for this failure is clearly and unmistakably that of the governor of Illinois and the Republican state senators. I resent the imposition of this increase, and I join the thousands of CTA users in their feeling of anger about it. The recent special session of the legislature, called by the governor for the special purpose of supporting the CTA and mass transportation throughout the state, was a complete and tragic fiasco.
If they share my opinion, which was that this bill that hung up the entire procedure was really of no consequence, and that is my opinion, the referendum was not a serious matter, then it would have been a political move on their part. And I had suspected and said this before, that I questioned whether they were truly interested in resolving the problem or creating a political issue. And now we'll find out.
An inflation alert was issued by the White House in early December, criticizing wage and price developments by several industries. Who was to blame? The auto workers' strike ended with pay increases totaling 20% over a 3-year period. Congress agreed to pay hikes for postal workers while pushing through a bill creating an independent government agency to run the post office. And Congress okayed a 13.5% pay increase for the members of 4 rail unions who walked off the job despite a federal court back-to-work order. The chairman of the House Banking and Finance Committee, Wright Patman, questioned the White House predictions of a better financial situation.
He said that interest rates are too high. And before I get through this statement, I will give a solution, a reason. What we should do to lower interest rates. I didn't hear that reason given. I was waiting for it. He did not propose a way to do that, the way I understand it. The president's message is totally inadequate for the economic crisis facing the nation. It offers too little, too late. Probably the speech should have been made much over a year ago. It is a weak statement, which sounds so much like an echo of the remarks we used to hear from President Hoover in the late 1920s and early 1930s.
The economy, it affected everyone. And for some political observers, the situation was publicly expressed on November 3rd, Election Day.
A radical liberal will, at a time of rising prices, vote for every spending bill that comes down the pike, just as Lenore Romney's opponent has done. A radical liberal is the kind who runs out on America's great tradition of bipartisanship in foreign policy. That hallmark of statesmanship, the Democratic as well as Republican Party have abided by over the years. The incumbent senator from Michigan fits that description exactly.
Radical liberal became a household word. It was used by Vice President Spiro Agnew during his extensive campaigning here in Illinois and elsewhere for Republican candidates. It was a bitter campaign with Agnew and President Nixon the targets of anti-war demonstrators. In Illinois, the Democrats ousted an elected superintendent of public instruction, state treasurer, and an appointed senator.
I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you so very much to all of you who have been so very kind to me and so very helpful. Unfortunately, it didn't come out the way we tried to make it come out, but that's the way it goes. So thank you very much.
Ralph Smith later admitted that the public may not have understood the methods used by Vice President Agnew in his campaigning and may have been turned off by it. Taking Smith's place in Washington 2 weeks after the landslide election, Adlai Stevenson III. Nationally, the Republicans failed to gain the governorships or congressional seats they had wanted. President Nixon claimed, nevertheless, that he would have a working majority in the Congress. But on paper, the Democrats had picked up 11 governorships, 9 House seats, while Republicans had gained 2 Senate seats and, in a roundabout way, replaced Republican Charles Goodell of New York with a third-party candidate. In Cook County, the races for sheriff and superintendent of schools were close, with Democrats winning but Republicans contesting. The electoral process is a process of change, peaceful change, an orderly turnover. While America was in the midst of sometimes violent or fatal demonstrations for immediate action and change, Illinois moved through the slow and sometimes frustrating system to make way for drastic changes in its government. A 9-month-long session by 116 delegates in Springfield ended with a proposed new state constitution and 4 separate constitutional items for the voters to accept or reject. It was late on the night of December 15th when ConCon President Sam Witwer told some of the delegates.
Never could there have been a better group of delegates assembled. There were times when we kind of rubbed each other a bit, but how I love you tonight.
The main body of the Constitution was adopted, but Illinois voters turned down the merit selection of judges, the abolishment of the death penalty, giving 18-year-olds the vote, and single district voting for representatives. On April 30th, 1970, the Vietnam War officially became the war in Indochina.
Tonight, American and South Vietnamese units will attack the headquarters for the entire communist military operation in South Vietnam. This key control center has been occupied by the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong for 5 years in blatant violation of Cambodia's neutrality. This is not an invasion of Cambodia. The areas in which these attacks will be launched are completely occupied and controlled by North Vietnamese forces. Our purpose is not to occupy the areas. Once enemy forces are driven out of these sanctuaries and once their military supplies are destroyed, we will withdraw.
The Cambodian campaign went smoothly with tons of communist weapons and ammunition captured. President Nixon kept his promise to withdraw all American troops from Cambodia by the end of June. But the fighting continued in Cambodia, as it did in Vietnam. There was bitter debate in Washington, with the administration accused of usurping war-making powers from Congress. The Senate gave overwhelming approval to a ban on the further use of American ground troops in Cambodia. At year's end, American battle deaths were half the total of 1969, and thousands of GIs had been brought home under the president's withdrawal plans. In November, Defense Secretary Melvin Laird called a news conference, presumably to discuss the second so-called protective reaction bombing in North Vietnam to destroy enemy supplies or anti-aircraft weapons. But Laird had other information. He told of a daring mission deep into enemy territory to try and rescue American prisoners of war.
A key factor in the final decision to launch this SAR mission, this search and rescue mission, was the new information we received this month that some of our men were dying in prisoner of war camps. My recommendation was based on the same motivation that has prompted our steadfast readiness to mount the numerous search and rescue attempts in enemy territory whenever there is a possibility of a saving American lives. This policy has the president's strong and unqualified support.
At the Paris peace talks, there was a new American negotiator, David Bruce, but still no real sign of progress. Delegates exchanged only views on release of POWs, or at least information on who was being held where and in what condition. There was a pro-war rally in Washington led by radio preacher Reverend Carl McIntyre, a rally to show support for White House policies. And the first of the American soldiers to face court-martial in the alleged My Lai massacre, Staff Sergeant David Mitchell, was acquitted. At the beginning of May, as more and more GIs crossed over into Cambodia, the criticism reached the violent level on many of the nation's campuses. It was a time of change again, of not-so-peaceful change. Anti-Cambodia demonstrations broke out during the weekend, and National Guardsmen and state police were called out. By nightfall on May 4th, national focus was on Ohio's Kent State University. Guardsmen had been called to the campus because the ROTC building was burned, and demonstrating students had marched downtown and smashed windows. Despite a no-crowd order, hundreds of students gathered, surrounded the troops on three sides. Tear gas and rocks were thrown, and then suddenly, and irrevocably, some guardsmen opened fire. Four students were killed, 10 others were wounded, one paralyzed, perhaps for life. An Ohio grand jury indicted 25 persons, including the president of the student body, and accused the university of overindulgence and permissiveness. Were the shootings justified? The National Guard Assistant Adjutant General at Kent State, Robert Canterbury, answers.
Obviously, when four people lose their lives and nine are injured, the consequences are never justified. And I don't think you can broach it in those terms. I do think you have to approach it in the terms of the lives of the guardsmen that was being jeopardized. This is the only justification.
In October, a special report of the President's Commission on Campus Unrest said the National Guard at Kent State should not have been issued loaded weapons. Shortly after the incident at Kent State, two students were killed, 10 wounded, at predominantly black Jackson State College in Mississippi. A barrage of police gunfire riddled a dormitory after stones and bottles had reportedly been thrown at passing cars. The Commission on Campus Unrest called those killings unreasonable, unjustified, and overreaction on the part of Mississippi policemen. Vice President Agnew called the report pablum for permissiveness. There were many other protests by young people in 1970. There were major disturbances at Southern Illinois University and the University of Illinois, with National Guardsmen brought in. Hundreds of persons were arrested. 1970 was also the year of the homemade bomb. On August 24th, an explosion ripped through the Math Research Center at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. A graduate student was killed. Four young persons, two of them brothers, were still being sought at year's end in connection with that bombing. Corporate skyscrapers, campus buildings, courthouses, even the Chicago police statue in Haymarket Square, all were bomb targets in 1970. Three persons were killed in New York in March when a blast leveled a bomb factory at a Greenwich Village townhouse. One of the victims in that explosion was a young girl named Diane Oten. She was the daughter of a wealthy Alton, Illinois family, college-educated, a volunteer church worker in South America. New York police identified her as a member of the militant Weatherman faction of the SDS. Young persons were not the only ones demonstrating in 1970. As mentioned, in April there was a victory march in Washington. On July 4th, Reverend Billy Graham led an Honor America Day rally. And across the country, construction workers, the hard hats, became a symbol for love of country and pride in doing a day's work. Small American flags appeared everywhere, on automobiles, on construction hats, and the slogan was, "All the way, USA." The trial of the Chicago Seven finally came to an end in February. It came after 21 weeks of some of the most fantastic courtroom dramatics this nation has ever seen. The federal jury in Chicago, after deliberating for 5 days, acquitted all seven defendants of conspiracy to incite a riot during the Democratic National Convention of 1968. But five were convicted of crossing state lines with the intention of inciting riots.
I feel that the jury verdict was correct. I feel that the Circuit Court of Appeals will, like so few people have done, look at the 20,500 pages of record and will make its own judgment.
That's prosecuting attorney Thomas Foran. One of the defense attorneys, William Kunstler, disagreed, and his questions on the day of the verdict were still unanswered 10 months later as the year ended.
We don't want to harass the jurors. They've gone through 5 months of incarceration. We don't want to do anything like that. We want to question them as to how the verdict was reached, whether they gave in out of compromise or whether they gave in because they truly believed the defendants were guilty of the five substantive counts.
Judge Julius Hoffman imposed contempt charges on the seven defendants for their courtroom conduct and handed down sentences to the two defense lawyers for what he called fanning the flames of disorder in court. Judge Hoffman later presided at a hearing to determine if he was guilty of illegally communicating with the jury during their deliberations, a charge that could lead to a new trial. No decision was reached on that hearing as the year came to a close, taking the controversy of the Chicago Seven well into a third year.